The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
And welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Poncek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the markets team.
This week on the show, in a world dominated by factor investing and passive strategies, we often hear about the quote-unquote death of the stock picker. But is it actually true? We talked to a fund manager who ranked in the top 1 percentile of his category, and also, after years of underperformance, is the value factor dead?
And Sarah, before we start, I want to give a shout out to some of the listeners out there who have been providing valuable content for the program. Our longtime listener, that character, Twiggy Sunday on Twitter, he's contributed something for the craziest thing of the week segment. He also predicted that I would win the craziest thing of the week segment.
I think I missed that part of his tweet into the show.
He predicted that once again I will win. And you know the
brilliant. You're brilliant, Twiggy.
The listeners have confidence in my ability to find
that's
crazy.
That's clearly the truth of it.
Yeah. It doesn't matter that I'm the sole judge of it also. And also Ellie Panami.
We really thank you for your amazing contributions to our crazy things ideas. And we will eventually get one of your favorite guests back on the show.
We will. Ellie or Eli, or whatever his fake Twitter name is, decided that the craziest thing he saw in markets would be a like 30-year-old picture of our colleague Chris Nagy, which, you know, I gotta say to listeners out there, if you're thinking about tweeting us embarrassing pictures of our colleagues, just take a minute, think twice about it, and then absolutely go ahead and tweet them directly to us.
And there's also probably a better chance that if you were to ask us a question or share a crazy thing, that we'll actually use yours on the show.
Absolutely. And so remember, listeners can actually appear on the show if they call our special What Goes Up hotline, whose number I chronically forget. So hopefully you have it handy.
I have it handy, as always. It's 646-324-3490. So feel free to give us a call. And if you do, we may even play your message on the show.
But let's get right to it. And as you alluded to, we have a guest. And full disclosure, this guy is actually a good friend of mine. But that's not why he's on the show. He's on the show because he has the reputation of pretty much a rock star, I would say, as a stock picker. As you said, he managed.
He loves this.
He likes what he hears. But he was the head of the small cap team at JP Morgan Asset Management for a while. The small cap equity fund under his leadership, as you said, top 1%, won the Lipper Award in 2013 for the best fund over 10 years in the small cap category. 2009, it won the same award in small caps for best fund over 5 years. And Sarah, this is a guy whose brain I've been picking for years because we're both residents of the brainy borough of Metuchen. And typically my questions are like, hey, what do you think of the market? Is it overvalued? How about bond yields? Are they going to go too high? What about growth versus value? Hey, do you like small caps?
It's like you're asking me the wrong question.
That's right, right. No. And his answer will always be, Mike, I'm trying to coach my kids' basketball team here. Will you leave me alone? But finally, I'm excited that we can get him down to sit down and talk about his process of picking stocks. He's since left JP Morgan and started his own separate account business. It's called Byron Place Capital Management. I encourage you to Google it and check him out. His name is Glenn Garotsky. Glenn, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. This is great. Talk to people. And, this is wonderful.
Yeah, Glenn's been holed up in his office picking stocks. He doesn't get to see people too often.
Or daylight.
And also joining the show this week, we welcome him back to the show. He is a guy who wrote for a newspaper for a long time that many listeners probably saw. It's the one with the very odd colored pages, I think.
Salmon is the official name for it,
The Financial Times, it looks like it was printed on paper that was made from trees that only grow like in a Dr. Seuss book or something.
But that's a great analogy.
I have to say, having visited London and seen all, how many daily newspapers are still in business even today in London? It's got to be like 300, I think. So at least the color allows it to stand out on the on the newsstand. So I think that was it was a brilliant strategy.
It's been pink since 1893.
So it wasn't your idea.
No, it was not my idea. No, I wasn't around then. The most complaints the Financial Times ever had in one day while I worked there was on the centenary of when we went pink, when it was printed on white paper to emphasize how pink it normally looked. And so all these people from the City of London reading it for the share prices and stuff freaked.
It was
almost impossible. The switchboard actually collapsed on various occasions.
That's hysterical.
People were horrified that the FT had come out on white paper. This is a true story, indeed. I just told you it was really impossible to get anything done that day.
Anyway, that writer's name is John Authors. That voice you just heard, and now he's no longer writing on the pink paper. He's writing on that brilliant amber and black of the Bloomberg terminal screen.
Not amber, orange.
Orange.
Okay. Yeah. Amber.
Salmon and amber. Right.
Fancier.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. It's a much
not pink and orange. Salmon and amber.
But Glenn, let's start with you because, you know, as Sarah alluded to, I feel like the whole factor investing and passive craze has really just taken over the investing landscape. However, you're still managing year to year to pick stocks that beat the market. So walk us through your process. I know you start with a screen of stocks, and your current strategy is all caps. So you have some stocks, a couple hundred million in market cap to up to Facebook and
up to Microsoft. Yeah, up to 1.4 trillion, down to 100 million in market cap. So
happy to have Microsoft in the portfolio this year, I guess.
For sure. I mean that's really where the market has been rewarding, you know, sustainable cash flow. And that's really what's been working in this market, in this whole economic recovery that's, you know, 11 years into the making right now. But there's a lot of value in small cap. So, and it's undercovered.
Yeah.
And that creates a lot of opportunity for guys like me who, you know, feel very comfortable meeting with these companies and talking to these management teams and understanding their businesses.
Having an all-cap strategy to me sounds intimidating just because it's such a big universe. So walk us through, like, I know you run some screens for sort of price to free cash flow. What's your process for sort of narrowing down this massive universe?
Right. So first off, I started as a micro-cap analyst. So I looked at companies less than a couple hundred million in equity market capitalization. And then I moved to small-cap and mid-caps. And to me, I just wanted to look at more companies. I never wanted to limit myself. So I've always was itching to do all caps and look at everything under the sun. So, because I look at myself as a business analyst first and a securities analyst.
Yeah.
And that ultimately is an equity analyst and trying to decipher what a business is worth and what the equity of that business is worth. So the way I start is, you know, my rule of investing that supersedes everything and I never forget is that when I'm buying a stock, I'm buying an equity ownership stake in a business, and I never forget that rule. So I'm always looking to invest in companies that have a sustainable competitive advantage, that are run by management teams who have a track record of success and are good stewards of capital, and you want to buy these businesses in the stock market at a discount to their intrinsic value, so when they're undervalued. So it's all about looking for good businesses that are run by competent people and buying them at the right price. And you know, again, you know, so in the U.S. stock market, you know, let's just take the Russell 3000. If there's, you know, there's more than 3000 stocks, but I do run screens. I try to, I mean, you know, I'm kind of a financial nerd and a business nerd, and I like to look at everything under the sun and look at as many businesses as I can. But I have to run screens just to focus my, where I need to focus. So I do run static screens that, like you said, that like, let's say a price to free cash flow screen or that are valuation sensitive, but they tend not to change much. So I look for what I call inflection point screens, where I'll look for businesses where maybe there's insider buying or there's a management change or there's, you know, a company is doing a spinoff. Or a change in operating momentum. Those are the screens that generate kind of something interesting, because a lot of these times,
some type of catalyst
to make me take a second look at a business. I've been doing this for, 15, 20 years, so to make me look at a business again a second time.
And like I said, your stock picks are handily beating the market. So the strategy, the inception was in like early 2016, right?
February 16, yeah.
16. And so your equity picks are up 130% since then. S&P's up 80%. But the unusual thing about your strategy, at least one of the ones you run, is you don't go all in. You like to keep a really healthy cash balance, as much as, say, 40 to 50%. So what you end up with is very good risk-adjusted returns, a Sharpe ratio of like 1.6.
Right.
But very conservative. So walk us through kind of how you manage cash, because you'll flex between as much as 50% cash at some points.
Yep.
Kind of waiting for the dip. Is it as simple as that?
Yeah. Unfortunately, people may look at it and say I've been wrong, right? Because I've had a high cash percentage. It's up over 40% right now. The reality is, when I first started this, I worked at J.P. Morgan Asset Management for a long time, and I ran mutual funds there. And this was in the beginning. This was kind of a glorified family office, and I was managing my own money, and I wanted to manage it the way I thought was the right way to manage money, where you're not always saying, hey, you need to be in equities. So I wanted to have good risk adjusted returns. And the reality is, I hate to lose money. But I also understand that you have to take risk in order to make money. But I love the idea of having capital there that's there when the opportunity arises. And, I look at the portfolio from the bottom up, each stock on its own merit and its own risk reward. And I look at it from the top down as to, is it a good time? But really it comes from the bottom up. Mm-hmm. And I want to have that cash available to, all right, now's a great time to buy businesses that are on sale.
Right.
I don't see that right now. You could go back in February 16 was a great time. Unfortunately, the market came back so fast right there, and I didn't get all that cash to work.
Yeah.
But I'm happy if the market's going to be up 20%. I used to have this dilemma when I worked on a mutual fund, and it was a small cap mutual fund. And I'd have this argument with my analyst team all the time, and it was like, okay, the market's up 30%, and you're up 25%. Not good for my career necessarily, right? I'm not generating alpha. Or the market's up. Or the market's down 20% and I'm down 10%. I look like a hero from a relative perspective. Mm-hmm. That never sat right with me, right? Like, I don't like to lose money, right?
Yeah.
In the financial crisis, I looked like a hero, even though I lost, I don't know what the numbers were, but I lost 20% or something. I looked better relative to everybody else. And, the reality is I hated the idea of playing this relative game always, so...
So it's certainly been hard to find an opportunity to put money to work. Even this past week, you have the S&P, the NASDAQ, the Dow, all hitting fresh record highs. John, I want to come to you because this is all in the face of we have a spreading coronavirus. UBS was out saying that the most compelling bull case right now is that there is no credible bear case at the moment. What do you say to a line like that? Because I've heard it a couple times this week. The market keeps going up because there's no reason to be bearish, even when I think a couple people would argue against that.
Huh. I can think of a few reasons.
I figured you could.
Right. That being said, I've been very good at coming up with reasons to be bearish for the last 10 years. and they all seemed like really good, elegant, logical points, and they weren't totally right. Coronavirus could yet really mess things up. And it's not necessarily, it doesn't need to be the second Black Death. It doesn't need to be Spanish flu. It just needs to close down Chinese industry for long enough to put out people's calculations, people's expectations that they have been relying on. In particular, given the parlous state of Europe, there is no country in the world that is more exposed to China, amazingly, than Germany. In many ways, Germany's manufacturing has been showing serious signs of decline. And then after that, you call it craziest. Apparently, it's very charming that I refer to it as the maddest thing that I see in the markets.
Wait, don't spoil it.
If you look at the US market, bring a British guy to my aid, said that the markets can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent, which is very true. And markets can be overpriced, and they can still get more overpriced. So you should never try to time the market based on valuation. That said, price to sales is not, it's one of the simplest, most straightforward, least manipulable numbers right. out there. And on a price to sales basis, the S&P has actually caught up with the top in 2000.
Yeah.
This isn't, we don't have to have arguments about Shiller's Cape, which is actually nowhere near as expensive as it was in 2000. This is a good straightforward indicator that suggests that unless it doesn't even require the economy to slow down, if American companies get a little less good at absolutely squeezing every last inch of, every cent of profit out of their sales, they are going to look terribly overpriced.
Right.
So there were a few reasons to be bearish there, right?
Have you?
And Bernie.
Of course, yes.
I mean, Larry David. Yeah, just I can't do a Larry David level impersonation of Bernie.
Can you try though?
No, come on. Okay. I'm not. It's only a few months. For some reason, people took Elizabeth Warren very seriously.
Right.
And so, when we had the season of people announcing their previews for 2020, which like Christmas comes earlier every year, so it was before Thanksgiving. People were terrified of her.
Right.
She doesn't call herself a socialist. She calls herself a capitalist. Bernie is now looking stronger than Elizabeth Warren ever did, and he calls himself a socialist, which is not market friendly,
right?
Because markets are capitalist.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
Let's get into some of these names in your portfolio, because I love looking at different managers' portfolios, and oftentimes you're like, wait, you sure that you look at it and you're like, you sure this isn't an index fund? You do not make that mistake with Glenn's picks, which is what I love. You know, I'm going to skip over sort of the Microsoft, United Health, and I'm going to quiz authors on if he's ever heard of some of these companies. Same weighting as Facebook, 1.7%. Habit Restaurants.
Okay. All right. So they just got bought by Yum Brands.
Okay.
Get out of them. They're exposed to China in a very, very big way.
Yeah.
But what caught your attention there?
Yeah. So I...
The same thing has caught Yum Brands' attention.
Yeah. I first saw them in November 14 when they IPO'd, and it kind of was at the same time Shake Shack came public. And these guys are a competitor in California. They're in Santa Barbara, California, and compete with In-N-Out Burger, of course, who's the dominant player there. And they have, I knew the CEO. His name's Russ Bendel. He ran this company called Mimi's Cafe when they were private. I met with them. And so they came public. They had great unit economics. They 50% burger, but what they do, everything's fresh, high quality food. What they do differently is they're kind of more so, they'll have a good female presence. They'll have good seared ahi tuna and salads. And so it was a differentiated concept.
I'm starting to get hungry.
You're making us hungry, yeah.
And so the stock took off, and it IPO'd in the mid-teens and went up like Shake Shack, when everybody wanted to own restaurant stocks.
Yeah.
And a lot of these companies came public. And it went, you know, went into the 40s. I watched it. I was intrigued by the concept, but the valuation was ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then as the restaurant stocks went out of favor, it collapsed. I mean, it was in the single digits. They were still executing, and it got, you know, close to replacement value on a, you know, a business that generates, you know, their unit economics are 25% returns on invested capital. So it got really attractive to me, and I started to take a position. And ultimately, I was hoping for a higher price than what they got taken out for. I was hoping this would get into the 20s, but it got taken out at 14 by Yum Brands.
One more before we get to the craziest thing, because I think this one would be interest to our listeners who are actually in the money management business. Diamond Hill Investment Group, 1.3 weighting, and your portfolio is never more than like 30 stocks, right? It usually
It's 15 to 40 stocks right now. Right now I'm at 26, 25. Yeah,
but tell us about Diamond Hill Investment Group, because I mean I feel like asset management firms are somewhat radioactive to a lot of investors these days. The active managers. What do you see about this stock?
Right, nobody wants to own active managers right now. So Diamond Hill, they're in Columbus, Ohio, mostly equities. Large cap value, you know, I followed them for a long time. We owned it actually in our small cap portfolios when I was at JP Morgan. It got really expensive. They've done very, very well. It has $22 billion in assets under management now. And it got really cheap, right? And I took a second look at it. I saw it, they hired a new CEO, Heather Brilliant from Morningstar. And there was insider buying. And I took a look, and I'm like,
checking
holy
all
cow,
your boxes
it's
there.
6.7 times enterprise value to NOPAT. Now, I run an investment management business. This is a really good, well-run company that's an active manager, but it's not like they're charging egregious fees. The average fee is 60 basis points. They have a long-term track record. I would love to own this business. If this was in the private markets and I could buy it for 7 times, you know, and they have a pristine balance sheet, I'd own it all day and just wait it out. Now, I don't know that's the beauty of the stock market. There's this volatility. And, you know, if you have an idea of what you think a business is worth, there's a lot of opportunity and you just wait it out.
For those who've been waiting around lists for the craziest thing we saw in markets, it's time for your payoff. Sarah, I'm not as confident as I usually am in my...
You weren't confident last week either.
Yeah. No.
I don't think so.
I think I still won though, didn't I?
Because you say that you win every single week. I think if there was a popular vote here, I'm not sure that you would win.
Right. Yeah. Do I get one vote or how many votes?
I mean, you get four
I get like
votes.
A super vote.
You overrun
voting
everyone. Yeah. Right. You get a super vote.
All right. Let's start with that character, Twiggy Sunday, who the craziest thing he saw in markets this week, I think John Arthur's as a British Red Sox fan, you'll appreciate that. He noticed that Keith Richards gave up smoking, and he thought that might have some market implications. In fact, I looked at Altria's share price. It's down like double digits since the middle of January. So I think
that's the reason.
I think Twiggy might have won this
He's
week.
Onto
I don't
something.
Know. Yeah, yeah. So that's a good one. But I'll start with mine because I'm not as proud as of this one. But I saw a story. I think it was CBS. Someone sold a single parking space. So we're talking about the real estate, the parking space, real estate market in San Francisco. Glenn, what would you pay for a parking space in Metuchen, New Jersey?
I'd pay $55 a month. I'm on the Metuchen Parking Authority, actually. The treasurer of the Metuchen Parking Authority.
So you
get a discount.
In San Francisco, though, what would you pay in San Francisco?
I
have no idea. I've seen the article, so I'm going
to... 800 to own a parking space in San Francisco?
800 a month?
A month. I mean, I think of
this is to buy it permanently.
Oh, okay. Oh. No, way more.
Yeah. But John Arthurs, what would you pay for...
To have a car in San Francisco. I would pay so much to avoid having to drive in San Francisco in the
negative,
first place.
Negative interest rates.
Your negative yielding space. 100 grand for a parking space in San Francisco.
Good grief. Oh. How much could you buy? Is there anywhere within the city of San Francisco you could buy a studio apartment for 100 grand?
Absolutely not. No,
right.
Absolutely not.
Or maybe it's not totally, on a relative basis, maybe it's not totally, completely, clinically insane then. But.
Right. And the way people live in San Francisco, they might just pull a van up in that space and live there. You know,
it happens.
It happens. All right, Sarah, can you top a $100,000 parking space?
Maybe not, but there was a great story by our hedge fund reporters here at Bloomberg, and the headline was 5 hedge fund heads made more than $1 billion each last year. But the part that I really found interesting was that if you look at the returns of their funds last year, three of the five all lagged the S&P 500 by at least 10%, essentially. So the idea that you can make $1 billion and you don't have to do too, well.
The two is more powerful than the 20 in some businesses, I guess.
But, yeah.
All right, Glenn, I know I warned you about our craziest thing.
Yes.
I hope you came prepared.
I know you're a Philadelphia 76ers
absolutely,
fan, Mike,
absolutely.
And we have a Celtics fan here, too. I see the Red Sox around John's neck. So I'm going to touch on somebody that you both know. The Sixers' big offseason signing, Al Horford, who's one of the most underrated NBA players for a long, long time. Right, but you know he's
real value 30, investor here.
33 years old. Sixers are paying him $28 million a year. Okay, the Sixers have underperformed a little bit this year. They've just made him the backup center this week. as I was watching the Sixers Clippers game, which the Sixers won, and I'm a Sixers fan too. Full disclosure. That
to
me was ridiculous. $28 million for a backup center. And then I have one more, which is my nerdy. This is more nerdy finance guy. Okay?
All right.
I own Apple, full disclosure. Okay. I've owned it for a long time. And the value, you know, what's interesting, so it's earnings season right now. So Apple reported their fiscal Q1 that ends at 12/31. So I was on their conference call doing my work. I have notebooks, right? Yeah. And I was looking at the numbers compared to 2 years ago. And so Apple, this just shows what interest rates have done. And their perception, Apple's business has probably gotten better from 2 years ago from a perception standpoint, now that AirPods are doing pretty well and they have more of a service business. So you could argue their business model's a little better. But operating income in this quarter, $25.569 billion, okay?
Not bad.
2 years ago, same time, they did $26.274 billion in operating income. More operating income. Apple's operating income is down over 2 years. Enterprise value of Apple.
Oh, yeah.
Right now, $1.36 billion. Enterprise value back
trillion,
then.
Trillion, right?
$1.36 trillion. Enterprise value, 12/31/17, you know, on that quarter, after that quarter, $646 billion.
That's pretty crazy.
So the enterprise value has doubled, and they're making the same amount of money.
Wow.
Now, they've done share buyback and stuff like that, so you can juice the EPS and stuff.
But even just the
P's,
that just shows. Like 25, 26
Yeah. So, I look at it from an enterprise value notepad standpoint, so you can take out the cash. Yeah, it went from 20, it basically doubled. They're multiple. But
Mike, I think we might be crowning a new winner.
All right. We'll give it to... Well, now we got to hear John.
We got to hear John first.
But John will give us the maddest thing he's seen in markets.
Well, this is something I picked up in a column yesterday. I spent years of my life, literally years of my life, checking first thing in the morning what the spread of Greek bonds over German boots was.
Naturally.
And amazing to relate, we have now got to the point where the spread of Greek bonds over German bunts is back where it was before the Greek election in October 2009. When the new prime minister got in, he discovered that there was a hole in the accounts and that Greece had been understating its deficit.
Right.
And it's when he announced that the full Eurozone crisis starts. And apparently it's safe to go back in the water now, because at long, long last, the Greek crisis, if you believe the bond market, is over.
Yeah, your headline on that column I loved. It was like the European sovereign debt crisis is over, which kind of reminded me of like Bush on the aircraft carrier with the mission accomplished banner behind him. So hopefully you have better luck with.
Well, the problem with this is because that was written. I was edited by Matthew Brooker, who is also British. There's so many people assume that we actually mean what we say.
Did you get some hate
we
now?
We think we're. Obviously,
sarcasm is
deep in cheek.
Yes,
and yes, I've had one or two. I actually had one or two very strange tweets by right-wing Italian politicians about this.
Interesting.
I'm trying to get to the bottom of, but anyway, there we go. I find the market has convinced itself that the entire existential crisis over the euro is now over.
Yeah.
And as I said at the outset, I actually think there are many, many... it's changed, and it's now more about the center than the periphery. Yeah. But I would not be too relaxed.
Well, you know,
about the Eurozone.
The spread is one thing, but the Greek 10-year yield alone is mm-hmm. like less than 1%. If we see Greek 10-year yields go negative, I don't know. I think I'm going
to... We'd need to pay to the privilege of lending money to Greece. Yeah. Yes, that would be quite
shocking. That would be used on the craziest.
That'll be a future craziest thing.
And with that said, Glenn and John, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thank you.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek. Mike is at Reaganonymous. John Authors is at John Authors. And of course, you can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcast is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.